Journalist Nan Robertson calls Alcoholics Anonymous the most successful, most imitated, yet most misunderstood self-help movement of the 20th century. She wanted to tell the real story of AA because it's a subject she's passionate about. Alcoholics Anonymous saved Robertson's life. Her new book is an inside view of AA called Getting Better. At the end of the book, Robertson steps out of her role as journalist and historian and tells the story of how she became a drunk and how she got sober. Robertson has written for the New York Times for the past 40 years. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her 1982 article on toxic shock syndrome. She nearly died of this rare infection in 1981, just 6 years after she gave up drinking. I spoke with Robertson from the NPR Bureau in New York. There is a tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous that members remain anonymous at the level of press, radio, and television. Nan Robertson violated that tradition by using her name on her book. I asked her why.
I wrote the book and signed my name because I wanted to help not the people in AA who are already getting help. There are a million members in this country alone. I wanted to help the outsiders who are suffering, the alcoholics and the members of their family. There are millions of those out there, and they're the ones who really need help. People in AA, such as myself, are already getting help. I think that the people who read this book deserve to know who I am and where I come from, and that I'm a journalist with 40 years' experience, and that I'm a recovered alcoholic in AA for 12 and a half years. I will take the responsibility for breaking my own anonymity. It is something between me and my own conscience. And the only promise I made when I was researching this book was I said to every alcoholic and every member of Al-Anon, which consists of the families of alcoholics, that their identity would be absolutely protected, and I have kept that promise.
Did you feel that you needed anybody's permission or anybody's blessing within AA before writing the book?
Well, I did go to see Lois Wilson, who is the now 97 years old. She is the widow of the co-founder, Bill Wilson. And we talked about this book. And after I described how I wanted to demystify AA, it's a widely admired organization, without any question the most successful self-help organization of the 20th century and one of the most imitated, if not the most imitated. But still, the outside world is full of myths and misconceptions about AA and Al-Anon. They think we're a bunch of religious nuts. They think you have to sign something, swear something, take the pledge for life, that it's gloomy in there. We all sit around sort of crying the blues. And I said to Lois, I want to write an outside book. I want to do the history. I want to tell what it's like today. This is the only book that's ever been written for the outside. All the literature that you will read about AA is what you get in AA. It's not sold in bookstores. It is written by anonymous people. It is authorized by AA headquarters, and that means it is censored. I would not write an authorized book on my mother or on the New York Times. I am a journalist. I have certain standards, and I will not be censored. But I told everybody that this would be an unauthorized book, although I got cooperation from AA headquarters and from alcoholics all over the country and in Mexico. And I told them that I was going to write it under my own name.
One more question before we get to some of the history of AA. Did you have to feel distanced enough from your own former drinking habit before you could write this book? For instance, I think a trap a lot of journalists fall into is to take things that are dear to them or important to them and deal with them as a journalist, because as a journalist, you're always distancing yourself.
That's right.
And for you, I mean, you probably had to really deal with alcoholism before it was safe for you to distance yourself and deal with it as a journalist instead of as an alcoholic, a recovering alcoholic.
Yes, yes. That's kind of a painful tug, you know? I mean, I owe my life to AA, really. And yet, I'm a journalist of more than 40 years' experience. I attempted to do it. I could not have written this book earlier. during my early years in AA, when I was really subsumed into the organization. I've always had a very rich life outside AA. I have many friends who drink moderately. I have many friends who don't have alcoholics in their life, who are not, I mean, I don't have any friends who are active alcoholics except those that I help into AA. But of course, there is that dichotomy. There is that pull. I have done the best I could. I dedicated the book to the anonymous alcoholics who saved my life. That gives you some idea of the emotion that I feel about the organization.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Nan Robertson is my guest. Her new book is titled Getting Better, Inside Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's talk a little bit about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the founders was named Bill Wilson. Alcoholics Anonymous is really the model for self-help groups in the 20th century. Can you give us an idea of how he found out that he would be helped by helping others and by having others help him? It's a pretty new idea, I think, this kind of self-help.
It certainly is. In 1935, when the two founders met, the idea that one drunk could help another drunk, provided that the first drunk was sober, was absolutely unheard of. It was thought to be crazy. But that is how all of us have kept each other sober, kept ourselves sober, by helping others. And this was an idea that came to Bill Wilson in 1935. He was in Akron on a business trip. Through a series of calls, he finally met Dr. Bob Smith, a practicing surgeon, a drunk who was going down the tube. Bill had then been sober for 6 months. The two men met in the house of a woman who wanted to get them together, who was not an alcoholic. And the two men talked for 6 hours. The thing that Dr. Bob said after emerging was that this man had been through it, that this man knew as no other human being knew what he himself, Dr. Bob, had been through. And that is how we help each other. You go into AA and you know that everybody there has been through what you have been through. That's an enormously powerful incentive to A, be helped, and B, help others.
So AA was founded in around 1935. Now, if we went back to the late 30s and looked at some of the early AA meetings, how would they compare to the kind of meetings that AA has now? They were more religious, for one.
They were much more religious. You had to surrender to God and to your powerlessness over alcohol on your knees. These were tiny groups. The meetings were held in people's homes. They were extremely secret. They were not held in public places. No women were allowed.
Why no women?
Because the drunks of that era, the male drunks, including Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, believed that nice women, were never drunks. That's a sort of Victorian ideal. But for a very long time, there were no women as members of AA. And also, they were not young. They said if a person was below 35 and hadn't lost his job and hadn't lost his family and hadn't lost everything, that he hadn't suffered enough to be a member of AA, all of which has changed. So it was strongly male, strongly white, strongly middle-aged or older, and people who had fallen very far.
And strongly Christian as well.
Strongly Christian.
Now, that's something that's changed. I mean, there's still a spiritual element to AA, but as you pointed out earlier, a lot of people think that the members of AA are kind of religious fanatics. And
yes.
I think the words God and spirit are mentioned in the kind of code, aren't they?
God is mentioned about five times, directly or indirectly, perhaps even directly, in the 12 steps. And this throws people off a lot, even though it's God as we understand him.
Yeah, so what does it mean that you're supposed to have whatever kind of interpretation of a power larger than yourself?
That is right. And for many, many people, including really myself, although I'm sort of a maverick Christian, my higher power has always been the group, the other members of AA, who have come to my aid in moments of enormous crisis, without any thought of reward, without hesitating. I have done this for others. It's a chain that began with these two men in 1935 and has now grown into hundreds of thousands of people helping each other, being helped, staying sober, returning to a life of quality.
Three of the kind of mottos for AA is one day at a time, keep it simple, and I am responsible.
Yes.
Would you give us a brief sense of what those three things mean to people in AA?
Yes. One day at a time sounds like a ridiculously, even stupidly simple slogan, and that's the way most people feel when they go into AA. What it means is this is the first temperance movement, first movement to get people sober, who does not say you must take the pledge never to have another drink until the end of your life. Now, that is the most daunting thing to say that. And so they say, I won't take that next drink. So we say, I won't take that next drink. I won't take it in the next hour. And then if you have an urge, you say, I won't drink now. I won't drink today. And it is so much less daunting to say, I will be sober today. Yesterday is over. Tomorrow hasn't happened yet. I can't do anything about this. I'll just remain sober today. Almost anyone can do that.
What about keep it simple?
Keep it simple is if you are surrounded by a whole bunch of demands that make you tense, that make you that make things complicated, try to sort things out and see what is the simplest thing. One of the simplest things is you're sober. You know, that's something to cling to. I remember a woman in my group saying the only perfect thing, I mean, everything was going wrong. Her work, she'd lost her lover. I mean, her kids were mad at her. And she said, the only perfect thing I did today was I didn't have a drink. Now, that's something. It's something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And the I am responsible is, it means wherever there is anybody out there who needs the help of a recovered alcoholic, I am responsible to be there. And if anything described this book, despite the distress of some alcoholics within AA that I have broken my anonymity, that is what I am doing. I am trying to reach many, many people who are suffering terribly, who are suffering needlessly. And that's really what getting better is all about. It's not about how wonderful things are for me now that I'm in there. It's been a long, turbulent recovery. But this book is to help people who don't know about AA to open a door onto that secret anonymous organization and say, hey, this is what goes on in there. This is why we get better.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what goes on in there. Now, when you first went to AA, you said it took you 4 months to stand up and introduce yourself. And
yes.
With the standard opening, which is...
And I'm not shy.
And you're not shy. You can't be as a journalist. You can't be too shy.
No.
You have to learn how to push your way through events.
Right.
So what's it like the first time when you walked in?
Well, first of all, I felt a sense of relief, you know? I mean, you know...
Because you'd admitted it and you'd kind of gotten yourself there.
Well, not only that, that everybody in the room was alcoholic like me. They knew all the lies. They knew all the denials. They'd made fools of themselves at parties. They'd fallen asleep. I wasn't a very dramatic drunk. I mean, I was mostly boring. But you also listen to stories of people who were much worse than you were, which is extremely comforting. when you sit there. Also, nobody makes you stand up. Nobody makes you sign your name. You go in there. You sit down. Someone may offer you coffee, or you can go to the urn. Finally, the meeting starts on time. Somebody reads the preamble to AA, the fact that the only thing you need to join is to have a desire, not an honest desire, not a sincere desire, a simple desire to stop drinking. And you sit there, and you listen. That's all. That's all you do at your first meeting.
There weren't any ground rules you had to learn or anything? No initiation into the code?
No. You just sort of learn along the way. It is the most unstructured, the most anarchic organization I've ever even known about in 40 years of reporting. I mean, everybody sort of does what they do what they need to do to help others. And there is intense discussion inside a closed AA meeting. Closed means for alcoholics only, or those who believe they may have a drinking problem. The open meetings have three speakers generally, and they're more formal. People stand up in front of the crowd, and there's very little floor discussion. But the real nitty gritty, the real sort of drama and combat humor of AA can be viewed in the closed meetings. They're incredible.
You know, I think the recent changes in AA is that there's a lot of specialized groups now. There's some gay groups. I think there's some Jewish groups and some groups for black members. Is that seen as a good thing, this kind of specialization, or are some members of AA a little worried that it's getting too homogeneous, these groups, too isolated from others?
I think they're called vestibule groups. Mm-hmm. On the whole, they are not encouraged by AA headquarters. They like general groups that have straights and gays and blacks and whites and Jews and Gentiles and so on. And they don't encourage that. There are, of course, language groups. There are Hispanic groups. There are French-speaking groups. In New York City alone, there are 1,800 meetings of AA every single week of every year, and they reflect neighborhoods, blocks, everything. If you don't like one, you go to another. You can get a meeting book free by calling Alcoholics Anonymous over the phone. There are specialized groups, which are fine. You can go into a group. If you don't feel comfortable with another group, you can start a group of your own. AA is more like a sort of organism than an organization. It keeps breaking off into groups that say, I don't like this group, so I think I'll start one of my own. But it's also, AA is very inclusive. There are more gays, more blacks, more Jews, more of the dually addicted. The most important thing, the most important change in AA in the last decade since I went in has been the enormous influx of young people, and almost all of them are addicted to alcohol and to another drug.
Now, you mentioned in your book that some people objected to these dual addictions because it was complicating things a little. Instead of us all having the same problem, someone else has this other problem too, and all the members would understand.
Some of the old timers don't like it so much. They say this society was formed to help alcoholics and alcoholics only. Druggies have their special problems. I haven't found that they necessarily do. But the point is, there is Narcotics Anonymous for druggies. But it's amazing how those who are dually addicted are just streaming into AA, and they are young. There are almost no purebred alcoholics in that generation anymore. They are taking another drug besides alcohol, and on the whole, they are being welcomed.
My guest is Nan Robertson. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who writes for the New York Times. Her new book, Getting Better, is an inside look at Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Nan Robertson is my guest, author of Getting Better, Inside Alcoholics Anonymous. You've been a newspaper writer for around 40 years now, and in your new book you write that your generation of newspaper writers really consisted of two-fisted drinkers.
Yes.
And I was wondering if, as a woman, you felt when you were getting started that you really had to learn to drink as much as or even more than the men as a way of proving yourself?
Yes. I do think that. To be one of the boys was a compliment when I went into journalism in 1948. And you did have to do almost everything better to be noticed. I was also very young. I started my career in Europe as a foreign correspondent. And really, it was a badge of maturity if you could drink very hard and hold your liquor. You know, you were one of the boys at last, or one of the men. This separated the adults from the kids. And if you drank well and held your liquor and sort of could do it to late at night, that was terrific. If you drank not so well, you were messy or ugly or whatever, then people found you amusing, and they would make jokes about you. That was sort of the environment that I went into as a woman of 22. That's when I started becoming a professional journalist. It was definitely a badge of maturity to smoke and drink like crazy.
So you think that helped get you into trouble?
Yes, I do.
One of the principles in AA is that change comes when a person reaches a state of desperation and collapse.
Yes.
Did that happen to you? Was that when you knew that it was time to get some help, either through AA or through a clinic?
Yes, and you can never tell when that state of collapse is going to come. There's sort of a funny term called, you know, high bottom or low bottom. It means where you reach the point where you can't go on any longer, where you're sick of being sick. That's called your bottom, hitting bottom. Other people have compared this phenomenon to an elevator that always is going down. And some people, like myself, get off on a fairly high stop. I didn't lose my family. I didn't lose the love of my friends. I didn't lose my job. I didn't become unkempt looking, but I was an alcoholic, all right. I finally reached that point of saying, I can't go on. I've got to have help, with the aid of two doctors, who said to me, you're an alcoholic, you need help. And I went to Smithers, one of the best known and most successful intensive rehabilitation centers for alcoholics in New York in 1975. And that, like all the other good rehabs, it was AA oriented. I'd first learned a lot about AA in there, and then went directly out of it and started going to 90 meetings in 90 days, which is what they suggest for newcomers.
Really? So you go to a meeting every single day?
For 90 days, and if it hasn't taken by then, you know, give it a try. That's it, you know, and if it doesn't, I mean, about 40% of all newcomers do drop out, which is another myth about AA, that it's successful with everyone. It's not. It's successful with slightly over half of the people who try it and really give it a chance, you know?
You know, when you were at the point of having to admit to yourself that you had an alcohol problem, you certainly weren't ready to admit it to others just yet. And there was a point where you tell the story in your book, and I think it's a wonderful story. You really didn't want to tell your mother.
Oh, yes.
Would you tell that story?
Oh, dear. Yes, when I was in Smithers, you go into residence for a month. This was, and I was to go out to Illinois to visit my mother and my family for Thanksgiving dinner that year in 1975. And but I was in Smithers, and I wouldn't get out until early December. So I had to call her and to tell her that I was going to, that I wouldn't be able to make it. And I was going to lie to her. It's very easy for a reporter to lie and say, oh, well, I'm terribly sorry, I have an assignment elsewhere and whatnot. The members of my therapy group inside Smithers said, you cannot lie to your mother. You cannot lie to yourself. You must tell her where you are and why you can't come to Thanksgiving dinner. And I said, oh, my God, it's going to kill her. She's 83 years old. She was born in Victorian times. I can't use the word alcoholic. And one guy said, why don't you just use the word problem drinker? I said, this, you know, I really felt this would kill this woman, gutsy as she was, to know that the shame of it, you know, the shame of it to know that her daughter was a drunk. So I went sort of sweating into the patient's telephone booth, and I called Mother, and I told her that I couldn't come out for Thanksgiving dinner that year. And I told her, Mother, I said, I'm in the most wonderful place with the most wonderful people. I was just oozing this kind of counterfeit charm. I said, there are stockbrokers and there are welfare mothers and all these terrific people. And quick as a shot, my mother said, is that a place for alcoholics? And I was stunned. And I said, well, Mother, well, yes, Mother, there are a few problem drinkers among us. And Mother said to me, oh, Nan, darling, you've made me so happy. I've been worried about your drinking for years. And I still choke up a little when I think about it. She was wonderful. And she told me when I called her on Thanksgiving Day, she told me that I had given her the best Thanksgiving gift of her life.
Well, I think that
by doing something about myself.
There's almost like a lesson in there, you know, that people who are close to you have figured this out long before you have.
Everybody knew. Everybody knew. After a while, I called up all my close friends and announced joyously, I'm an alcoholic. Well, of course they all knew I was an alcoholic. They all knew, you know. It is the worst kept secret in the world from people who love you.
I want to ask you something about the way you end your book. You end your book by describing that after you'd given up alcohol and you felt that your life had really kind of gotten back on track. You were struck with toxic shock syndrome. You were hospitalized. You nearly died. Your fingers got gangrene, and you had to have the tips of them amputated. This became the subject of your Pulitzer Prize-winning article. But you end your book by explaining how here you were in bed and think just really angry at the world for having been hit with this terrible disease just when you thought you were really better and ready to live again. And you said the two friends of Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, came in to see you. and that really changed things around. What did they tell you? Who were they? I guess you can't tell who they were. But
they were strangers.
They were really strangers.
I had told the hospital before I went into a coma, when I was admitted into the emergency room, I had explained to the hospital authorities that I was a recovered alcoholic and AA for years. Therefore, that would mean that they couldn't use certain medicines on me that might be addictive and so on. and then I slipped into a coma, and then the really sort of the hard time began. And I got, when I was well enough to be taken off the respirator, I was furious at everybody. I thought my life had ended, that nobody would love me anymore. I was terrible to my family. I was terrible to the nurses and doctors. I was full of rage. And then one day, these two strange women stood in the doorway of my room. I'd never seen them before. I looked at the nurse and said very imperiously, "Who are these people?" And there was a little pause. And then one of the women said, "We are friends of Bill Wilson." And the idea that AA was there somehow assuaged my grief and my anger. They sat down. We talked. I welcomed them in. They explained there was an AA meeting in the basement of the hospital every Sunday night at 7. I went there as long as I was in the hospital in a wheelchair. It was wonderful to be among my own again. They did something for me that my friends could not do, that my family could not do, that the doctors and dedicated nurses could not do. That is the power of AA. And the next morning, when I woke up, my anger was gone, and I said to myself, "Nan, you have everything to live for."
Well, thanks for telling us a little bit about your story and for filling us in on the history of AA. Thank you very much, Nan.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Nan Robertson has been my guest. She's the author of Getting Better, Inside Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just been published by William Morrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.